Father Cayetano de Laura was invited by the bishop to wait for the eclipse beneath the canopy of yellow bellflowers, the only place in the house with a view of the ocean sky. The pelicans, motionless in the air on outspread wings, seemed to have died in mid-flight. The bishop, who had just finished his siesta, moved a slow fan in the hammock hung from naval capstans on two wooden support beams. De Laura sat beside him in a wicker rocking chair. Both were in a state of grace, drinking tamarind water and looking over the rooftops at the vast, cloudless sky. Just after two it began to grow dark, the hens huddled on their perches, and all the stars came out at the same time. The world trembled in a supernatural shudder. The bishop heard the fluttering wings of laggard doves searching for their lofts in the darkness. "God is great," he sighed. "Even the animals feel it." The nun in his service brought a candle and several pieces of smoked glass for looking at the sun. The bishop sat up in the hammock and began to observe the eclipse through the glass.
"You must look with only one eye," he said, trying to control the whistle of his breathing. "If not, you run the risk of losing both."
De Laura held the glass in his hand, but did not look at the eclipse. After a long silence, the bishop scrutinized him in the darkness and saw his luminous eyes indifferent to the enchantment of the counterfeit night.
"What are you thinking about?" he asked.
De Laura did not reply. He looked at the sun and saw a waning moon that hurt his retina despite the dark glass, but he did not stop looking.
"You are still thinking about the girl," said the bishop.
Cayetano was startled despite the fact that the bishop made this kind of accurate guess with almost unnatural frequency.
"I was thinking that the common people will relate their troubles to this eclipse," he said.
The bishop shook his head without looking away from the sky.
"Who knows, they may be right," he said. "The cards of the Lord are not easy to read."
"This phenomenon was calculated thousands of years ago by Assyrian astronomers," said De Laura.
"That is the answer of a Jesuit," said the bishop.
Cayetano continued to observe the sun, not using the glass out of simple distraction. At 2:12, the sun looked like a perfect black disk, and for an instant it was midnight in the middle of the day. Then the eclipse recovered its earthbound quality, and dawn's roosters began to crow. When De Laura stopped looking, the medal of fire persisted on his retina.
"I still see the eclipse," he said, amused.
"Wherever I look, it's there."
The bishop considered the spectacle finished.
"It will go away in a few hours," he said.
He stretched and yawned as he sat in the hammock and gave thanks to God for the new day. De Laura had not lost the thread of their conversation.
"With all due respect, Father," he said, "I do not believe the child is possessed."
This time the bishop was alarmed in earnest.
"Why do you say that?"
"I believe she's only terrified," said De Laura.
"We have an abundance of proof," said the bishop. "Or have you not read the actor?"
Yes. De Laura had studied them with great care, and they were more useful for understanding the mentality of the abbess than the condition of Sierra Maria. They had exercised the places where the girl had been on the morning she entered the convent, as well as everything she had touched. Those who had been in contact with her had submitted to fasting and purification. The novice who had stolen her ring on the first day was condemned to forced labor in the garden. They said the girl had enjoyed quartering a goat whose throat she slit with her own hands and had eaten its testicles and eyes with spices as hot as fire. She had displayed a gift for languages that allowed her to talk with Africans from any nation better than they could among themselves or with any sort of animal. The day after her arrival, the 11 captive macaws that had adorned the garden for 20 years died for no apparent reason. She had charmed the servants with demonic songs sung in voices other than her own. When she learned that the abbess was looking for her, she had made herself invisible only to her eyes.
I believe, however, said De Laura, that what seems demonic to us are the customs of the blacks learned by the girl as a consequence of the neglected condition in which her parents kept her. Take care, the bishop warned. The enemy makes better use of our intelligence than of our errors.
Then the best gift we could give him would be to exercise a healthy child, said De Laura.
The bishop bristled. Ought I to assume that you are in a state of defiance?
You ought to assume that I have my doubts, father, said De Laura. But I obey in all humility.
And so he returned to the convent without having convinced the bishop. Over his left eye he wore the patch that the doctor had prescribed until the sun imprinted on his retina was erased. He sensed the glances following him through the garden and along the series of corridors that led to the prison pavilion, but no one said a word to him. The entire convent seemed to be convalescing from the eclipse. When the warder opened Sierra Maria's cell, De Laura felt his heart bursting in his chest, and it was all he could do to remain standing. To test her mood that morning, he asked the girl if she had seen the eclipse. She had, in fact, from the terrace. She did not understand why he had to wear a patch over his eye, when she had looked at the sun without protection and felt fine. She told him that the nuns had watched on their knees and that the convent had been paralyzed until the roosters crowed. But to her it had not seemed anything otherworldly.
"What I saw is what I see every night," she said.
Something had changed in her which De Laura could not define, and its most visible symptom was a trace of sadness. He was not mistaken. As he began to treat her wounds, the girl stared at him with troubled eyes and said in a tremulous voice, "I'm going to die." De Laura shuddered.
"Who told you that?"
"Martina," said the girl.
"Have you seen her?" She told him that Martina had come to her cell twice to teach her embroidery and that they had looked at the eclipse together. She said that Martina was good and gentle, and the abbess had allowed her to hold the embroidery lessons on the terrace so they could watch the twilights over the sea.
"Aha," he said without blinking. "And did she tell you when you're going to die?"
The girl nodded, her lips closed tight to keep from crying.
"After the eclipse," she said.
"After the eclipse could be the next 100 years, said De Laura.
But he had to concentrate on the treatment so she would not notice the lump in his throat. Sierra Maria said no more. He looked at her again, intrigued by her silence, and saw that her eyes were wet.
"I'm afraid," she said.
She collapsed on the bed and burst into heart-rending tears. He moved closer and comforted her with the palliatives of a confessor. This was when Sierra Maria learned that Cayetano was her exorcist and not her physician.
"Then why are you healing me?" she asked.
His voice trembled.
"Because I love you very much."
She was not aware of his audacity. When he left Sierra Maria, De Laura stopped at Martina's cell. Close to her for the first time, he saw that she had pockmarked skin, a shorn head, a nose that was too large, and the teeth of a rat, but her seductive power was a material current that could be felt at once. De Laura chose to speak to her from the doorway. "That poor child already has enough reasons to be frightened," he said. "I beg you not to add to them." Martina was taken aback. She would never dream of predicting the day of anyone's death, least of all that of a girl who was so appealing and defenseless. She had only asked about her circumstances and had realized after 3 or 4 answers that she lied out of habit. Martina spoke with so much gravity that De Laura knew Sierra Maria had lied to him as well. He asked her to forgive his rashness and begged her to demand no explanations from the girl. "I will know what to do," he concluded. Martina enveloped him in her charm. "I know who your reverence is," she said, "and I know you have always known very well what to do." But de Laura was wounded by this evidence that Sierva Maria needed no help from anyone to nurture a horror of death in the solitude of her cell. In the course of that week, Mother Josefa Miranda sent the bishop a formal memorandum of complaints and protests written in her own hand. She asked that the Clarissons be relieved of the guardianship of Sierva Maria, which she considered a belated punishment for faults that had already been purged many times over. She enumerated a new list of extraordinary occurrences that had been cited in the acta and could be explained only as the consequences of shameless complicity between the girl and the demon. She ended with a furious denunciation of Cayetano de Laura's arrogance, his free-thinking, his personal animosity towards her, and the abusiveness of his bringing food into the convent in defiance of the prohibitions of their rule. The bishop showed him the memorandum as soon as he returned, and de Laura read it where he stood, not moving a muscle of his face. When he finished, he was in a rage. "If anyone is possessed by all the demons, it is Josefa Miranda," he said. "Demons of rancor, intolerance, imbecility. She's detestable." The bishop was surprised by his vehemence. De Laura observed this and tried to speak in a calmer tone. "What I mean," he said, "is that she attributes so much power to the forces of evil that she seems like a worshipper of the demon."
"My investiture does not permit me to agree with you," said the bishop, "but I would like to."
He reprimanded de Laura for any excess he might have committed and asked him for his patience in enduring the abbess's unfortunate nature.
"The Gospels are filled with women like her, some with even worse defects," he said. "And yet Jesus exalted them."
The bishop could not continue because the thunder resounded over the house and then rolled out to sea, and a biblical downpour cut them off from the rest of the world. The bishop lay back in the rocking chair and was shipwrecked in nostalgia.
"How far we are," he sighed.
"From what?"
"From ourselves," said the bishop. "Does it seem reasonable to you that a man should need up to a year to learn that he is an orphan?"
And since there was no answer, he confessed to his homesickness.
"The very idea that they have already slept a night in Spain fills me with terror."
"We cannot intervene in the rotation of the earth," said de Laura.
"But we could be unaware of it so that it does not cause us grief," said the bishop. "More than faith, what Galileo lacked was a heart."
De Laura was familiar with these crises that had tormented the bishop on nights of melancholy rain ever since old age had assailed him. All he could do was distract him from the attack of black bile until sleep overcame him. Toward the end of April, a proclamation announced the imminent arrival of the new viceroy, Don Rodrigo de Buen Lozano, who would stop here for a visit on his way to the seat of government in Santa Fe de Bogotá. He was traveling with his entourage of magistrates and functionaries, servants and personal physicians, and a string quartet presented to him by the Queen to help him endure the tedium of the Indies. The vicereine, a distant relative of the abbess, had asked to be lodged at the convent. Sierva Maria was forgotten in the heating quicklime and steaming pitch, the plague of hammering and the shouted blasphemies of all kinds of people who invaded the house as far as the cloister. A scaffolding collapsed with a deafening crash, killing a bricklayer and injuring 7 other workers. The abbess attributed the disaster to the malevolent spells of Sierva Maria, and took advantage of this new opportunity to insist that she be sent to another convent until the festivities were concluded. This time her principal argument was the inadvisability of allowing someone possessed to be in close proximity to the vicereine. The bishop did not respond. Don Rodrigo de Buen Lozano was a mature, elegant Asturian, a champion at pelota and partridge shooting, who compensated with his other attractions for being 22 years older than his wife. He laughed even at himself with his entire body, which he lost no opportunity to display. From the moment he felt the first Caribbean breezes intermingled with nocturnal drums and the fragrance of ripe guava, He removed his springtime attire and wandered bare-chested among the gatherings of ladies on board ship. He disembarked in shirt sleeves, with no speeches and no salutes by the Lombard cannon. In his honour, fandangos, bundes and cumbiambas were authorised, although they had been prohibited by the bishop, and bullfights and cockfights were held outdoors. The vicereine, an active and somewhat mischievous girl just past adolescence, burst into the convent like a windstorm of change. There was no corner she did not examine, no problem she did not consider, nothing good she did not wish to improve. She wandered through the convent, wanting to see everything with all the eagerness of a young novice. The abbess, in fact, thought it prudent to spare her the unpleasant impression of the prison. "It is not worth the visit," she said. "There are only two inmates, and one is possessed by the demon." That was enough to awaken the vicereine's interest. She did not care at all that the cells had not been prepared and the inmates had not been notified. As soon as her door was opened, Martina Laborde threw herself at the vicereine's feet, begging for a pardon. It did not seem probable after one failed escape and another that had succeeded. She had attempted the first 6 years earlier, along the terrace overlooking the sea, in the company of three other nuns condemned for various reasons to a variety of sentences. One of them escaped. This was when the windows were sealed and the courtyard beneath the terrace was fortified. The following year, the three remaining prisoners tied up the warder, who at that time slept in the pavilion, and fled through a service door. Martina's family followed the advice of their confessor and returned her to the convent. For 4 long years she had been the only prisoner, with no right to receive visits in the locutory or hear Sunday Mass in the chapel. A pardon seemed impossible. The vicereine, however, promised to intercede with her husband. In Sierra Maria's cell the air was still harsh with quicklime and the lingering traces of pitch, but a new order prevailed. As soon as the warder opened the door, the vicereine felt bewitched by a glacial breath of wind. In a corner, illuminated by its own light, Sierra Maria sat in her torn tunic and stained slippers, plying a slow needle. She did not look up until the vicereine greeted her. In the girl's eyes, she saw the irresistible force of a revelation. "By the Blessed Sacrament," she murmured, and stepped into the cell. "Take care," the abbess whispered in her ear. "She is like a tiger." The abbess seized her arm. The vicereine did not go in, but one glimpse of Sierra Maria was enough for her to resolve to save the girl. The governor of the city, an effeminate bachelor, gave a luncheon for men only in honor of the viceroy. The string quartet from Spain and a bagpipe and drum ensemble from San Jacinto played, and blacks in costume performed bold parodies of white dances. As a finale, a curtain at the back of the room was raised to reveal the Abyssinian slave purchased by the governor for her weight in gold. She wore an almost transparent tunic that heightened the peril of her nakedness. After showing herself to the ordinary guests, she stopped in front of the viceroy and the tunic slipped down her body to the floor. Her perfection was alarming. Her shoulder had not been profaned by the slaver's brand. The initial of her first owner had not been burned on her back, and her entire person breathed an air of intimacy. The viceroy turned pale, inhaled deeply, and with a movement of his hand erased the unbearable vision from his memory. "Take her away, for God's sake," he ordered. "I do not want to see her again for the rest of my days." Perhaps in retribution for the governor's frivolity, the vicereine presented Sierra Maria at the dinner the abbess gave in her private dining room. Martina Laborde had warned them. "Don't try and take away her necklaces and bracelets, and you'll see how well she behaves." It was true. They dressed her in her grandmother's gown, the one she had worn when she came to the convent. They washed and combed her unbraided hair so that it trailed behind her, and the vicereine herself led her by the hand to her husband's table. Even the abbess was stunned by the girl's elegance, her physical brilliance, the prodigy of her hair. the Vicerine murmured in her husband's ear. She's possessed by the demon. The Viceroy refused to believe it. In Burgos, he had seen a possessed woman who defecated without pause the entire night until she filled the room to overflowing. Trying to avoid a similar fate for Sierra Maria, he had her examined by his physicians. They confirmed that she showed no symptoms of rabies, and they agreed with Abrenuncio that it was improbable she would contract the disease now. But no one believed himself authorized to doubt that she was possessed by the demon. The bishop took advantage of the festivities to reflect on the memorandum from the abbess and on Sierra Maria's final disposition. For his part, Cayetano de Laura attempted the purification that precedes exorcism and shut himself away in the library with nothing to eat but cassava bread and water. He failed. He spent delirious nights and sleepless days writing unrestrained verses that were his only palliative for the raging desires of his body. When the library was dismantled, almost a century later, some of these poems were discovered in a sheet of almost indecipherable papers. The first, and the only one legible in its entirety, was a recollection of himself at the age of 12, sitting on his student's trunk under a light spring rain in the cobbled courtyard of the seminary at Avila. He had just arrived from Toledo after several days on muleback, wearing an outfit of his father's that had been altered to fit him, and travelling with a trunk that was more than twice his weight because his mother had packed in it everything he might need to live with honour until the end of his novitiate. The porter helped him carry it to the middle of the courtyard and then left him to his fate in the rain.
"Take it up to the third floor," the porter told him, "and they'll show you where you sleep in the dormitory."
In an instant, the entire seminary appeared on the balconies overlooking the courtyard, watching to see what Cayetano would do with the trunk, as if he were the single protagonist in a play known to everyone but him. When he realized that no one would help him, he removed as many things as he could carry and took them up the steep stairs of living rock to the third floor. The proctor showed him his place in the two rows of beds in the dormitory for novices. Cayetano put his things on the bed, went back to the courtyard and climbed the stairs four more times until he had finished. At last, he took the empty trunk by the handle and dragged it up the staircase. The teachers and students watching from the balconies did not turn to look at him as he passed each floor. But the father rector was waiting on the third floor landing when he brought up the trunk, and he began the applause. The others followed suit and gave him an ovation. Then Cayetano learned that he had passed with flying colors the first initiation rite of the seminary, which consisted of carrying one's trunk up to the dormitory without asking any questions or requesting help from anyone. His quick intelligence, good disposition, and strong character were proclaimed as examples for the other novices. But the memory that would make the greatest mark on him was his conversation on that first night in the office of the rector, who had arranged to see him to discuss the only book found in his trunk, its binding torn and the title page missing, just as Cayetano had discovered it in one of his father's chests. He had read as much of the volume as he could during the nights of his journey, and he longed to know the ending. The father rector wanted to hear his opinion of it. "I will know when I finish reading it," he said. The rector, with a relieved smile, locked the volume away. "You will never know," he said. "It is a forbidden book." 24 years later, in the gloom of the diocesan library, he realized he had read every book that had passed through his hands, authorized or not, except this one. He shuddered with the sensation that an entire life had ended that day. Another, unpredictable life was beginning. He had started afternoon prayers on the eighth day of his fast when he was informed that the bishop was waiting for him in the drawing room to receive the viceroy. The visit was unplanned, even by the viceroy. The inopportune idea had occurred to him during his first excursion through the city. He was obliged to contemplate the rooftops from the flowering terrace while urgent messages were sent to nearby functionaries and some order was imposed on the drawing room. The bishop received the viceroy with six clerics from his general staff. He sat Cayetano de Laura on his right and introduced him with no title other than his complete name. Before beginning the conversation, the viceroy examined with commiserating eyes the peeling walls, the torn curtains, the cheap local furnishings, the clerics dripping with perspiration in their indigent habits. The bishop said with injured pride, "We are the sons of Joseph the Carpenter." The viceroy made a gesture of comprehension and launched into account of his first week's impressions. He spoke of his illusory plans to increase trade with the English Antilles once the wounds of war had been healed, of the benefits of official intervention in education, of promoting arts and letters, and bringing these colonial outposts into harmony with the rest of the world. "These are times of renovation," he said. Once again, the bishop had confirmed the facile nature of secular power. He extended a trembling finger toward de Laura, not looking at him, and said to the viceroy, "Father Cayetano is the person here who keeps abreast of those innovations." The viceroy followed the bishop's finger and saw a remote expression and startled eyes that looked at him without blinking. With real interest, he asked de Laura, "Have you read Leibniz?" "I have, Excellency," said de Laura, and specified, "in the course of my duties." By the end of the visit, it became evident that the viceroy's greatest interest was the case of Sierra Maria. "For its own sake," he explained, "and for the peace of mind of the abbess, whose suffering had moved him to pity." "We still lack definitive proof, but the actor of the convent tells us that the poor creature is possessed by the demon," said the bishop. "The abbess knows this better than we do." "She thinks you have fallen into a snare of Satan," said the viceroy. "Not we alone, but all of Spain," said the bishop. "We have crossed the ocean sea to impose the law of Christ, and we have done so with masses and processions and festivals for patron saints, but not in the souls of men." He spoke of the Yucatan, where they had constructed sumptuous cathedrals to hide the pagan pyramids, not realizing that the natives came to Mass because their sanctuaries still lived beneath the silver altars. He spoke of the chaotic mixing of blood that had gone on since the conquest, Spanish blood with Indian blood, and both of these with blacks of every sort, even Mandingo Muslims, and he asked himself if such miscegenation had a place in the kingdom of God. Despite his obstructed breathing and his old man's cough, he ended without conceding a pause to the viceroy. "What can all this be but snares of the enemy?" The viceroy showed his distress. "The disenchantment of your grace is of the utmost gravity," he said. "Do not view it in that light, your excellency," the bishop said in the most courteous manner. "I am only attempting to clarify the strength of faith we require so that these people may be worthy of our sacrifice." The viceroy returned to his original subject. "To my best understanding, the misgivings of the abbess are practical in nature," he said. "She thinks that perhaps other convents would be better suited to so difficult a case." "Well, your excellency should know that we chose Santa Clara without a moment's hesitation because of the fortitude, the competence, and the authority of Josefa Miranda," said the bishop. "And God knows we are not mistaken." "I will take the liberty of telling her so," said the viceroy. "She knows it all too well," said the bishop. "What concerns me is why she does not dare to believe it." As he spoke, he felt the passing aura of an imminent attack of asthma, and he hastened to conclude the visit. He said he had received a formal memorandum of complaints from the abbess, which he promised to resolve with the most fervent pastoral love as soon as his ill health allowed. The viceroy thanked him and ended the visit with a personal courtesy. He too suffered from an obstinate asthma, and he offered his physicians to the bishop. This did not seem fitting to the prelate.
"Everything that pertains to me is in the hands of God," he said. "I have reached the age at which the Virgin died."
In contrast to their greetings, their leave-taking was slow and ceremonious. Three of the clerics, de Laura among them, accompanied the viceroy in silence along the lugubrious corridors to the main entrance. The viceregal guard kept the beggars at bay with a wall of crossed halberds. Before climbing into his carriage, the viceroy turned to de Laura, pointed at him with an unappealable finger and said, "Do not allow me to forget you." His words were so unexpected and enigmatic that de Laura could do no more than bow in response. The viceroy drove to the convent to tell the abbess the outcome of his visit. Some hours later, as he was about to leave, he refused to pardon Martina Laborde, despite the repeated pleas of the viceroyne, because he thought it would set a bad precedent for the many people incarcerated for lesser crimes whom he had found in other prisons.